You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to America's Web Radio. It's time now for the Classic Car Show with Tom Cox and Richard Lintonello.
So, here we are. We're back. And
we are.
I'm sitting here, and today, sadly, no Frosty Dr. Pepper. I know it's a first.
No? What happened?
I've just got a Frosty Schweppes ginger ale this morning. today. Yeah. Frosty ginger ale. We'll go back to the Frosty Dr. Pepper soon enough.
Well, just so you know, I had my Dr. Pepper last night. So I think I had
good.
Two. So I had one for you without even knowing.
Yeah.
So
see, there you go. Of course, you were drinking Dr. Pepper when you were in Brooklyn, right?
Oh yeah. I love it. My favorite drink. So
yeah.
It's so addicting. You got to watch yourself.
Oh yeah. Here, near the mountain retreat, so Roanoke, Virginia, for years and years has had the highest per capita consumption of Dr. Pepper products, and so they actually have a Dr. Pepper Day here every year where they give out T-shirts and free Dr. Pepper. So, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I even had one yesterday.
Be a pepper.
Be a pepper. Well, I even had one yesterday when I was in my garage. I finally got back into my garage on Saturday. It's been literally like 6 months, been like 9 months that I actually have done anything for a variety of reasons. And I started working on my Spitfire again, and, I got the front lower valance out that I bought a spare one about 10 years ago, and stripped it of the paint and, did some metal work to it, straightened it out, and it really feels good to get back in the garage and start working on projects again. It really does. Had the door open. It was 65 degrees. It was like, okay, this is life. This is good. This is what I enjoy. I should do it more often because it makes you feel good, working on your stuff.
It's mentally relaxing, physically challenging, and all of those things. I mean, it's just positive, positive, positive for me.
Right.
It just, I get out there, I crank up some tunes, I have a Frosty Dr. Pepper out there, and I lay all my stuff out, and I'm jamming to the tunes, I'm working on the car. It doesn't get any better.
No, it doesn't. And it's, no matter what you do, no matter what kind of car it is, no matter what kind of work you're doing, at the end, you look back, you see what you've done. It's just rewarding. It's like, you're getting something accomplished instead of sitting on the couch watching TV and doing nothing. So, I actually even started my Triumph, and I drove it around the block a few times. And, when I redid it several years ago, I replaced all the brake lines and everything, and since the entire brake system was new, I put in silicone brake fluid. And now I find that the pedal is so much harder. Maybe there's air in the system. I mean, I bled it several times. But you really got to press on the pedal to stop. It's weird as opposed to, regular brake fluid. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
you have any insight about that?
Now, that's an issue with silicone fluid. It just compresses at a different rate than the hydraulic fluid does.
It's noticeable.
It's a little bit more, some people say that it's harder. Certainly everybody generally says you've got to apply more pressure to stop. Some people will say it's a bit, that it feels a bit squishy. But I think that really depends upon the, orientation of all of the pedals and clevises and all that jazz.
Right.
And the master cylinder. I've never been a fan of it. I know a lot of people that love silicon brake fluid. But you've got to really make sure that everything that you, all of your components, and a lot of them are today, but make sure all of your components are compatible with it. Because if you have incompatible rubber products and the silicone together, it makes a mess of things, and then you end up having to rebuild everything
yeah.
again. So, yeah, it's I like my DOT3 and drain it out once a year. And I don't bleed it dry and replace the stuff, and then you don't have to worry about the moisture buildup and all that sort of jazz. And of course, as we've said on previous shows, you know, people, they have a can of brake fluid, they sit it up on the shelf.
No good.
2 years. 2 years. Two years, and then you throw it away.
Right.
And of course,
yeah, it absorbs moisture. Sure.
Dispose of it in an environmentally friendly way, of course. But, you know, you got that stuff on the counter, you go, on the shelf, and you're like, yeah, well, I'll just use that. I've got plenty of brake fluid. Well, you know, I've watched people, you know. It's like, how old is that thing? Well, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. I'm like, well, it's full of moisture, full of water, so you're putting all that into your brand-new brake system. So,
right.
You know, get off yeah. the money.
Well, you know, with the Triumph, with the Triumph, it has, you know, the master brake cylinder and the master clutch cylinder on a shelf. And when they leak, it just ruins the paint, everything. And it's all been restored and refinished. It's like, I don't want to ruin the paint. So I put in silicone if it does leak because, you know, these, you know, I hate to say it, but a lot of these British hydraulics are not that great. They just leak. And I just didn't want to ruin the paint finish that I just, you know, redid. So that's why I went with silicone. So maybe I'll you know, bleed them again and see what happens. I mean, the car does stop, but it takes a lot of pressure. So it is what it is.
Yeah. You know, it's probably a matter of getting used to it, too. You're just not
right.
used to putting the same amount of pressure on there.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Oh, well. So what else is new in the car world?
Hey.
We had an exciting weekend last week with what's happening down in Florida. A lot of crazy things going on.
A lot of craziness going on. A lot of craziness going on down there in Florida. I don't know. You got to wonder what the situation is. You know, you've got Amelia Island, and I think it's like now $150 to get into Amelia Island, something
yeah.
like that.
Yep. Yeah, just for Sunday. That's it.
Right. And then you've got all the money for parking that you have to pay for. Cars and coffee's
yep.
not free anymore. I think it's,
yep.
you know, I don't know, a $30, $40, $50 ticket. I don't know.
Plus $20 to park or $40 to park. Yep.
Right. So, I mean, it's a really, really, really expensive undertaking, big time. And, you know, you look at that and you look at the fact that you had a situation where, you know, when Hagerty came in and they bought out the Amelia Island Concourse.
Right.
And then RM Auctions, it had an auction there at the Crown Plaza Hotel there for many, many years. And then, of course, Hagerty had their own auction group, Broad Arrow Group. And so they moved Broad Arrow in there, and then they moved the other guys out. And when they did that, of course, upset RM, and so they've started their own deal down there in Miami, Moda Miami. So
same weekend.
I heard there was, yeah, same weekend,
yeah.
going toe-to-toe. But even more exclusive, like $500 for the ticket to get into Moda Miami. Now,
but that was a
great cars. I think they had
isn't that
eight
a weekend?
Or nine. Yeah.
But isn't
yeah,
the $500
yeah,
like a weekend pass, right?
It is. It is. Yeah. For, I think it is 3 days, you know, and they had
yeah.
eight Pebble Beach winners there. That's pretty much unheard of to have that many Pebble Beach winners.
Yeah, it you know, a lavish concourse, no doubt. But, you know, sadly, for the average working stiff, you know, these events are becoming way too expensive. And, you know, a couple of years down the line, I don't know who's going to be able to afford to go to these events. You know, it remains to be seen. So I wish everybody the best of luck. I hope they're all successful. And there's a lot of great cars to be seen and admire. But, man, is it expensive for the average Joe? It really is.
Yeah, yeah. The average person really doesn't have the opportunity to go out there and check out the cars and enjoy all of this. You know, and I used to love going to Amelia Island years back.
Me too.
It was a little pricey then, but it wasn't prohibitively pricey, particularly just since it's, you know, I'm only buying my ticket. You know, I'm not taking, myself, my kids, what have you,
right,
in there. You know, and you can go in and have a good time. But it's gotten to be crazy expensive and just the average guy. So, you know, what do you have for alternatives? Well, you can come to the Greenbrier. The Greenbrier is the first weekend in May, and admission is free. Totally free.
No charge. No charge
no
for
charge.
Parking either.
No charge for parking, no charge for admission, and you get to
the setting
walk
is great.
Around them. Yeah, it is. It's fabulous.
Yep.
Beautiful setting, and you can walk around, and there, you know, places to eat and things to go in. You can go inside the hotel. It's not like, as I understand it, down at Amelia now, unless, you know, in years past, if you were there, you could walk into the Crown, and you could
right.
eat lunch if you wanted to eat lunch there. But as I understand it now, you have to be staying at the hotel in order to go inside.
Right. Right,
and that's like $500, $700, $800, $900 a night. At Greenbrier, you can walk in, check out the shops, check out the beautiful architecture inside, get yourself something to eat, and so yeah, all free.
I know. The Greenbrier is like it's one of the best deals in this country when it comes to concourse. And, you know, you have other ones like the Keeneland, which is very inexpensive and a great setting. And, yeah, and then, of course, you know, we have the Grand National AACA, which is 600, 500 incredible automobiles, all free. So there are alternative events. Right, there are alternative events. But, you know, it is what it is, and these concourse events are really aren't much of a concourse anymore. Like you said, they're lifestyle events. It's, you know, look at me, I'm going here. Who wants to be seen, you know, with famous people and all that crap, which I don't care about. But it is what it is. What are you going to do? The changing of the hobby.
I agree. You know, and there's still some really, you know, Lake Mirror Concours came back last year down there in Lake
right.
Florida. I was there for that. It was a great event. It was pretty.
Free.
It was nice. It was free. And then right there juxtaposed to the Concours, they have, I don't know, probably 5, 6, 7 city streets shut down. And they have a big car show there, too. So, I mean, between the Concours and that car show that's next to it.
It's like 1,000 cars.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. And
it's
so,
amazing.
You know. Yeah, Lake Mirror is one that I would definitely put on the list, too. But coming up right around the corner for you and I, Charlotte, North Carolina, at the Charlotte Motor Speedway, we're going to have the AACA Grand National, a National, and the AACA Zenith Awards. Which the Zenith Awards will start out on Thursday, April 4th, and then the Grand National on Friday, April the 5th, and then the AACA National on the 6th. Talk about being able to see some really great cars up close, and guess what? Free. No admission. It's free.
No admission. You just got to pay for parking at the
gotta
speedway.
Got to pay for parking. Got to pay
that's
for
it.
Parking. But that's
and,
it.
And you got affordable restaurants on that Burton Smith Boulevard. Tons of restaurants and, you know, typical chains that don't soak you. So, yeah, if you want to see some of the most incredible, correct, you know, original type automobile and collector cars of all types, pre-war, post-war, American, European, come on out to the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And that's the first weekend in April, right?
Yep, 4th, 5th, and 6th. And
yes.
On Thursday, I'm just sitting here looking at the list of cars that we're going to be judging at the AACA Zenith Awards. There will be a special tent there just outside the Speedway. So the public is welcome to come in, check out the cars. Fabulous cars, because each of these cars that was selected as a competitor to be the best restored car of the year shown at an AACA event, and that's out of 2,500, 2,700, somewhere in that range, cars that were shown last year. And so it's boiled down to 18 cars, and you've got stuff in here. It's just crazy. Everything from a 1908 Mitchell to a 1963 Ferrari, G250 GTE,
nice.
A Duesenberg Phaeton, DeSoto Roadster, 58 Dodge D500 Regal Lancer.
Nice, rare car.
Some amazing stuff.
Yeah, and all perfectly restored. And, you know, the great thing about the Zenith is that, you know, there's only, what, you know, 15, 16 cars underneath this giant tent. And they're there all day. You could talk to the owners and find out more about the car and their restoration techniques and all that stuff. And it's a great learning experience. It really is, and very entertaining. So we'll be there. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's always the toughest judging I ever do. I'm seriously, and you understand it. You and I are both doing it. You finish, and you're trying to be so exacting, and, of course, all of these cars, there's just a hair's breadth of difference between them all in terms of the
right.
quality and restoration and everything. And at the end of the day, you have to really, really, really work really hard to make sure that you use the proper judgment. And then once we all get together and determine who the winner is, of course, every car there, as we say all the time, is a winner because they were, you know, chosen to compete. But the Zenith Award winner, we want to make sure we get it right. And
yep.
It takes a lot of energy to do that.
Oh, yeah, it does. It's not easy. I mean, you know, judging cars is tough, but when you're judging 16 perfectly restored automobiles, it's even tougher. know, it's probably the hardest judging I know I ever done, because you really got to check every little detail out. So yeah, it's going to be fun. A couple of weeks away.
Yeah,
come on out.
Yeah,
folks.
Looking forward to it. And you know, I'll be there. Rich will be there, and bring a frosty Dr. Pepper.
Yep, there you go. Oh, boy.
So, while I'm thinking about it, I'm going to put in a plug for an absolutely great event. And I'm just a little bit prejudiced here, just simply because I know the guy who's behind it, and I know how much work and how much effort he's been putting into this event. But that's the American Motors Owners Association International show that's going to be in Petersburg, Virginia, June 12th through the 15th. Chad Quella, I call him Cannonball, has just done a tremendous job with that. He has really gone all out. He and his group of people, they're going to go to the Keystone Tractor Museum. They're going to have an evening to discuss highball racing, Amos Johnson, and big guy involved in AMC teams, racing teams back in the day. He's going to be there. It's one of the first times he's actually done a public event like this. Everything is so reasonably priced. There's trips every day, special things at night. Even if you're not an AMC owner, you would enjoy coming to this event. It's just going to be a really, really great event, and it's not going to break the bank either.
Nice. I went to the AMO, AMC National Meet when it was in Knoxville last year, and you know, it's an interesting event. You know, you see cars that you don't normally see at other shows, you know, all kinds of AMXs and javelins and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Pacers.
Gremlins.
You
know,
Gremlins. Yeah. It's fun. Good meet. You'll have a good time.
Yeah, it's going to be a really good show. And yours truly will be the keynote speaker at the banquet, so you might want to, you know, avoid getting a banquet ticket. That way you don't have to listen to me.
Yeah,
but it's
going to
be a great event, great show.
Good.
So why don't we? It's 12:59. Take a quick break.
Wow. Okay, take a quick break, folks. Be right back.
When it comes to car magazines, are you tired of reading about mega-dollar collector cars you can't afford, or endless reporting on auctions and how-to tech stories that don't interest you? Then Crankshaft is the car magazine for you. Crankshaft is a 144-page softcover quarterly filled with all sorts of fascinating stories, the type of car features you won't find anywhere else. It features American and foreign cars, pre- and post-war era cars of distinction including sports cars, muscle cars, and regular family sedans too. To discover what many car enthusiasts are saying is the best car magazine ever published, you can purchase either a single copy for $12.95 plus $3 postage, or a one-year subscription, four issues, for $59.95. To order your copy, go to www.crankshaftmagazine.com. That's www.crankshaftmagazine.com.
Since the 1960s, J.C. Taylor has been America's premier specialty insurance provider for classic cars, antique autos, modified, and custom vehicles. Our customers have trusted us to protect their prized possessions for more than six decades. For more information, or to receive a quote, contact our expert team today by calling 888-ANTIQUE or by visiting our website at jctaylor.com/awr. That's 888-268-4783. Or visit jctaylor.com/awr. Drive through time with peace of mind. J.C. Taylor.
Veteran-owned, America's Web Radio would like to thank all of our incredible patrons. We wouldn't be able to do this without you. If you are not already a patron, you can help us continue to produce some of the most informative and entertaining shows on the internet by becoming a patron. Patrons of America's Web Radio are the first to receive information about new shows and links to the latest podcast episodes. Join now and receive a free gift while supplies last. For more information and to join our family, please visit www.patreon.com/americaswebradio. If you have questions, contact us at gm@americaswebradio.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
Hey folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday 1 to 2 only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember folks, I'm not angry, I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show only right here on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the americasbroadcastnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Okay, and now we're back. Back from our break. So what should we talk about this week? Anything of, you know, interesting? Any new cars in the, you know, Tom Garage? You know, I know you've been sending me some pretty cool deals, you know, via Facebook Marketplace. And, you know, there are a lot of interesting projects out there. Sadly, a lot of them are just rusty. And, you know, the older you get, the less you want to deal with rust. It's like you just want a car that you could get in and go. You know, maybe do some mechanical upgrades and things like that and detailing. But, you know, at this stage in my life, I don't want to deal with any heavily rusted cars anymore. I'm done. That's it. Too time consuming.
It's kind of funny. It's sort of like a rite of passage. When you're young and you get into the car hobby, and thankfully for young people today, cars 25 years old, unless they came out of Cleveland, they don't rust. But
right.
Back when you and I were kids coming up, you know, the stuff that was 25 years and older, it was rusty. If it came from the Northeast, you didn't even bother to touch it. But, you know, so it had some rust in the quarter panels, so it had a little rust in the rockers, a little rust in the floorboard. No big deal. I can fix that,
right.
You know.
Right.
Wrong. It's a pain in the butt. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's just a pain. Rust is the bane of my existence, and you're absolutely right. I do not want to do any more rust repair. I have one car that needs quarter panel work on both sides, a 65 Buick Wildcat convertible. But it's an otherwise all original car, 80,000 miles, one family owned, and I fell for it. It's a great driving car, and it's a good looking car. So I don't know. I may eventually just pay somebody to do it because I just hate working with rust that much. But it is funny how your attitude changes, you know?
It does. I just got off the phone a little while ago with my younger brother, David, and a couple of months ago he bought an MGA 1622 Roadster, and the car has almost no rust on it. However, it had been sitting for 10 years. So now he went to, you know, get it going, was working on it this weekend, and all the brakes are frozen solid. He started taking off, you know, to replace the master cylinder, and the hard line started snapping. Because, you know, I mean, when these cars were assembled back in the 50s and 60s, they didn't put any, anti-seize on the threads of the fasteners and the lines, and they didn't do any of that. And, you know, being mild steel and sitting for all these years, everything's got to be replaced. He was complaining, too. I've had enough of this stuff. I'm not going to waste my time anymore. So, even cars that are rust-free but have been sitting a long time, you're going to have issues. So just be prepared. That's part of the hobby, I guess.
You're right about that. My infamous 73 AMC Ambassador, the car that I accidentally bought for little money and thought I was going to, you know, get away with
make
a real
score.
Quick recommission, you know. Change out this, change out that, put a little fresh fuel in, flush out this and flush that, and there you go. No. Now I'm all the way down to, I just got the heads back, about a month or so ago. I hadn't had a chance to put them on. I want to spend the whole day, you know, just set aside the day, put the timing chain in, put the heads on, put everything back together, and get it all done in one day. So I just hadn't done it yet because I kind of hate to do half of it one day and then half of it a week later and that sort of stuff. Just I want to get in there and get it all done at one time. But that car is a perfect example. Car only has 64, 5,000 miles on it.
Yep.
No rust. But it had been in storage since early 80s.
And everything froze on it.
Yeah. You know, the exhaust valve on number one cylinder was stuck solid. So what do I had to take it all apart. I had to pull it all down.
Yeah.
It's just a good thing that I checked. I pulled the valve covers and checked to make sure everything was moving when I went to turn the engine over. If I hadn't done that, I would have had interference between that exhaust valve and number one piston, and that would have been a rebuild instead of just a head job.
Right. Well, you know, it's one of these things you got to make a choice. I would rather deal with replacing mechanical components and stuff than dealing with floors that are rotted out and you got to replace rocker seals and you know, B pillars and all that stuff. I'd rather deal with the mechanicals. But still, you know, you may find a rust-free car. I don't think you're going to just hop in and start driving it when the car's been sitting for 10, 15, 20 years. Nope, ain't happening, folks. But it keeps you busy, no. Keeps you out of trouble, keeps you in the garage.
Well, the thing about rust, as they say, rust never sleeps. And it's true,
right.
Although I'll have to say some of the new moisture-cured paints, POR15 and, you know, Eastwood and Hirsch, they both have their own version of that moisture-cured paint.
Right.
That it really does do a great job at arresting future rust from growing. Yeah. It does a great job. All of those products do. I really use POR15 mostly, and I love POR15 putty. If you have an area like in a floorboard that's really not rusted out, that's just a little weak, you just take a piece of hardware cloth, lay in over top of it, and then take and trowel in a little bit of that POR15 putty and let it harden out. And it gets rock hard, and it does a wonderful job, and it doesn't rust again.
Nice. Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Good to hear. Yeah.
But, yeah. No, I think probably, you know, here we are with spring on the horizon. A lot of people have probably got thoughts. In fact, I know some people are already pulling their cars out because the weather's been good. But, you know, check everything over before you just fire it up and head out of the garage. In fact, if you haven't been keeping your battery on a battery tender throughout the year, take and make sure you've got that battery charged up. You don't want to start it up on a weak battery and then overtax your electrical components, your alternator, et cetera, et cetera. You know, charge the battery up, check all your fluids, make sure everything is really good. Check your hoses, make sure there's no leaks, because, you know, when the car's been sitting in there for months on end in the garage, it's the best time to check to see if you have any coolant leaks. You know, look at, you know, all of your hoses, all your fittings, all of everything, just make sure it's okay. Take and grab especially your fuel lines and try to pinch them a little bit to see if there are any cracks in them so that they show any type of dry rot whatsoever. If there's any doubt, put new on. Replace it.
And fresh gas.
And fresh gas. Yeah.
Because that ethanol gas just doesn't last.
No. Fortunately, I have a Wally World nearby that sells ethanol free, so I can put all my cars away in the fall with ethanol free fuel.
I just found a gas station literally a mile from my house that has ethanol-free gas. And it's a little more expensive, but it's worth it because a lot of these rubber components, especially with British cars, that ethanol fuel just eats them away with the diaphragms and the carburetors and stuff. But, then you go out to your car after it's sleeping for a few months, and boom, it starts right up with the ethanol-free gas. So, little details, little things like that you got to, you know, be cognizant of. And don't forget, when you check your air in your tires before you take that, first test drive of the spring season, make sure you got the proper, air in the tires that inflated to the correct amount, because air does, filter its way out over the winter months, especially when it gets cold, So, that's important.
Make sure to have somebody check all your lights, your brake lights, especially,
right?
Particularly if you have a pressure switch, pressure activated brake light switch. Those things can get moisture in them over the winter, and then you go to take a nice joy cruise the first warm day you get, and you stop and somebody hits you in the rear end. You don't want to start off your spring driving season that way. Make sure all your lights are working. Turn signals, brake lights, everything. Just to be on the safe side. You don't know what happened between October and May or March or April, wherever you happen to pull it out.
You know, speaking of brake lights, with a lot of the older cars, whether they're, American or European, they had small tail lights, So the bulbs really aren't that bright. And I see a lot of conversions now where you could replace the bulbs with LED bulbs. So, you know, I'm thinking of doing that because if that little tiny taillight that's only 5 or 6 inches big, you know, if I could increase the, you know, the visualness of the bulb when I step on the brakes, I think it's worth it, you know. And they're not that expensive, you know. You want to increase the brightness of the bulb when you stop so other people will see you and you'll avoid accidents. So I think I'm going to do some conversions like that.
I absolutely think it's a great idea. You know,
yeah.
National Optical. Well, you can see I'm here at the office, huh? But anyways,
yeah.
No, I couldn't be with you more fervently than I think it's a great idea to replace with LEDs. This 1949 Chevrolet comes to mind.
Yeah.
When I think about tiny taillights. The taillights on that thing can't be much bigger than a postage stamp, okay? And if you've got a 6-volt bulb to begin with, it's already a little bit dimmer than a 12-volt.
Right.
So, yeah, by all means, I think it'd be a great idea to replace all of your turn signal, you know, flasher bulbs, all of that, side marker bulbs, all of those with LEDs. And, you know, it's like replacing your headlights with halogens.
Right.
You know, in AACA, we take points for judging if they know that you've replaced a regular bulb with an LED bulb, or if you've replaced your headlamps with halogen headlamps. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a safety upgrade. I think it's well worth it. It's so much better to be bright, be seen, increase your visibility, increase your safety, and lessen the chances that somebody's going to, you know, hit you if you're driving in the evening, driving at night. Take the point hit, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, the good thing about LEDs is that although they're probably, you know, twice or even three times brighter than a conventional filament bulb, they don't, you know, doesn't have any more heat. In fact, they have less heat. So you're not going to ruin the surrounding electrical components or the lenses and things like that. So it's a good upgrade, folks. Definitely consider it.
Yeah, we should consider trying to have that changed in AACA judging regulations.
I agree.
If nothing else, for everything but the headlamps, okay?
Right.
And, you know, if somebody doesn't see it, they can't take the point for it, but you do have people that really scrutinize it, and sometimes you can see through those lenses and see, ha-ha, it's got a LED bulb in there, in which case they'll take points. But, yeah, I think it should be a safety upgrade, just like seat belts. AACA doesn't deduct for seat belts that are added to any year car because it's a safety upgrade. So I think this is a safety upgrade, too.
So. Yeah. Yeah, whatever helps, because, you know, this time of year, especially when people are out there and they're driving now while texting and looking at their phone, not paying attention, I see that people are taking their cars out and getting into accidents, and not any fault of their own, is because of the mindless drivers on the road. So, you know, whatever you could do to increase the safety of your vehicle and ward off any potential accidents, we got to do it.
No. There are a lot of lunatics out there. You've got to be seen. You've got to be aware of what you're doing. And,
right.
Of course, you know, with your antique car, people are gawking. People are looking. People are so distracted,
yep,
as you mentioned, with the cell phones and everything else, and all, not to mention all the screens all the new cars have. I can't believe that, you know, the government is concerned about you being distracted because you're making a phone call, but yet now all these screens that are in all of these newer cars, those aren't distracting? My God. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep, that's why we love old cars. It's just the simplicity of it all, you know. It just makes driving enjoyable because you're connected to the road, you're connected to that steering wheel, you're not isolated, and you're the one who's driving the car's not driving you. So that's why we love old cars.
And there's something to be said for analog, that is for sure.
Yep.
So speaking of analog, you know, we were talking the other day about 50s cars. And
yeah.
Big three versus the independents and so on and so forth. So what do you think of being striking in difference between the big three and the independent manufacturers during the 50s?
Well, you know, I mean, the big three had the big bucks. I mean, I recently photographed for the next issue of Crankshaft magazine, I photographed a 58 Pontiac Bonneville hardtop, and you look at the detailing and the amount of stainless steel trim, and it's like, wow. I mean, there's got to be hundreds of pounds of trim on that car, and, you know, all the rocket ship inspired trim, and it's like, well, they did this because, you know, it's the big three. They have deep pockets. But then you compare that to, like, you know, a Rambler of the 50s or, you know, a Studebaker, and there's way less trim. The cars are cleaner looking, you know, mainly because those independent manufacturers didn't have, you know, the deep pockets like the big three. But so I look at some of these independent cars from the 50s, and I go, wow, it has, you know, it's the shape of the car that's really coming out. You're not being distracted by all this trim like, you know, take a 58 Oldsmobile or even the Buick. I mean, they're just loaded with all this bright work. And then you look at, like, you know, a mid-50, you know, an early-50s Kaiser. You know, you look at a Carolina and things like that, and it's like, wow, they're so clean-looking. You know, you're admiring the car for the design, not for all the bright work. So I think that there's a lot to be said for the independent cars of the 50s.
I agree. The 51 through 53 especially, but I really like the 54 and 55 too. But the 51 through 53 Kaisers, styled by Dutch Darren, God, he just did a great job on those cars. If they had been built by Ford or Chevy or Chrysler, I think they would have sold in much greater number than they sold. But just that heart-shaped windshield, the dips in the doors, the great the greenhouse design on those. I mean, you know, lots of glass. And you get in to those cars, and the dash is sort of inset and set away from you. And you've got all this leg room. It's like the dash is, like, way out there in front of you, you know. And it's padded, too. Just a central gauge cluster, just a great-looking car. And the materials that they used, they used some really, really interesting vinyls and they call it like bamboo vinyl, which is sort of a faux-woven bamboo. Just cool-looking stuff.
You know,
really, really neat.
You mentioned the hardtop styling. You look at, like, a 53 Hudson Hornet Hollywood model with that hardtop and that nice C-pillar in the back. I mean, that is just a great design. And you just have that single piece of trim going down the sides, you know. It's like, wow, what a beautifully shaped automobile. And I think, you know, 53 Hudsons, I don't think anything compared of the big three compared to that car, except maybe, you know, I'm kind of partial to the 53, 54 Lincoln Capri hardtops. I think those are great-looking cars, too. But of all the independent cars, I would say Hudson ruled the roost when it came to clean design in the 50s, except the later 50s
Frank's
Hudson.
Yeah,
the later 50s Hudson were a little too crazy.
Yeah, they're a little crazy. All that, what they call V-line styling, where they're had,
right,
you know, V's everywhere, all over the car, in the grill,
all over the car,
everywhere. V. of course, trying to instill the fact that they had a V8. Well, yeah, we got it, guys. We got
right.
it. You don't have to tell us 50 times over. But, yeah, no, the 53 Hudson is overall one of the most pleasant designs of the step-down design. Frank Spring did a great job with that. And then, of course, by virtue of the fact that it was a monobuilt design, it was really hard to change from year to year as far as styling was concerned. They did what I thought was a really masterful facelift in 54. The change from the 53 to the 54 was pretty substantial.
And the 54 Hudson is a nice looking car. It even looks like, you know, like the roof has been chopped a little. It has a lower profile to it.
Yeah, definitely. Has a lower profile. The windshield's definitely a little bit shorter on it. And really looked good. And they didn't actually put it into production, but, you know, you think about Hudson. They really blew it with the Hudson Jet. The Hudson Jet, and but the proportions.
Yeah.
The greenhouse was way too high, and it's said that...
doesn't work.
President Hudson got into the prototype, and he couldn't get in with his hat on, and so he had them raise the roof line on it so that he could get in and out with his hat on, and it just ruined the looks of the car. But they built one convertible prototype, and I think it's in the Sowers collection now, but it survived, and it has the original roofline dimensions that Frank Spring had originally intended for the Hudson Jet, and it looks great. That car looks so much better with just that lower. It looks like a miniature Hudson step down. It's just really, really a neat looking car.
Yeah, good stuff. Yep, those hard tops are nice looking style, nice designs, and boy. 50s cars, you know, they're just so attractive, and they had such a large palette of different colors and color combinations, and, you know, they're just so exciting to look at. They really are.
Now, I have one of those 57 Hudsons with all the V-line styling all over it, V here, V there. Yeah, I have one. 327, four-barrel, pretty potent.
It's a fast car.
Plant.
Yeah, it's a fast car.
Tritone, Mardi Gras red, white, and black.
Wow.
Three different colors, on that car. But you're right. The colors were fantastic back in those days. They really popped. Cars were so different. And the interiors, you stop and think about the Pontiac interiors of the late 50s. And the Chrysler interiors of the late 50s, where they used that metallic thread in the upholstery.
Yes. And isn't that fabulous?
It's great. It just looks...
In the carpeting, it has a little silver. Yeah, it's just... Yeah, I was in total awe when I photographed this 58 Bonneville. It was like, wow, it has that metallic stuff, like you said, in the carpeting, the door panels, and it just makes that whole interior come alive. And, you know... You're driving down the road, and you're looking at this beautiful dashboard that's made of metal, not plastic, and it has all this beautiful stainless steel and chrome trim and painted colors, and it's just a feast for the eyes. It's a visual feast. It really is. That's why, you know, 50s cars are just awesome. They really are.
No, they definitely tend to be my overall favorite, although the cars of the 30s really have a special place for me. And then Brass Era cars have a special place in my heart. And then, then there's the 60s cars. And then,
You know, the 61 GM bubble tops, you know, those sports coupes, I just absolutely adore. That's one of my favorite cars. So, early 60s cars were great. Joined the late 60s, you know, things started changing thanks to the government and the DOT regulations and bigger bumpers and all that stuff. So, you know, anytime the government gets involved in something, it never turns out well. But it is what it is. But, the independent manufacturers, too bad that there's not, you know, any of them left anymore, because not only was their styling different, but they came up with a lot of good innovations, mechanical innovations that that the other big three didn't.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hudson's first balanced crankshaft, and you know, just lots of innovation, because you know, frankly, the large companies, they were selling the heck out of cars, and they didn't really have the need to set themselves apart by investing in all this extra technology. You know, you think about it, it's like even Tucker 48. There's so many things that were implemented in the design of the Tucker 48 later on,
right,
their way into regular production cars, even though they ridiculed him at the time for coming up with that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what's that? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what do you think the craziest-looking car of the 50s? Which car do you think is the craziest-looking car, styling-wise?
Gee. Oh, I don't know. The craziest? I don't know. Wow, I really got to put my head together on that. For me,
55 Nash. 55 Nash with those headlights that were inboard of the fenders and set into the grill.
It was set into the grill.
Crazy looking. Yeah.
Well, wasn't that designed in Italy by Pininfarina?
They put the Pininfarina name on it, but Edmund Anderson, who worked for Nash, was really responsible for, let's say, 90% of the work. But George Mason thought it'd be really hip to have Pininfarina involved, and they really made a big splash over it.
Right.
But in the end, the actual final designs were more in-house by Edmund Anderson. But they really were kind of crazy, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think of crazy 50 designs, you know, although we're talking about independent cars, manufacturers, the 59 Cadillac, I mean, or even the 59 Plymouth, you know, with those big fins, I mean, that's some crazy stuff. It really is. So.
Totally over the top. Yeah.
Totally.
The 59 Plymouth, it actually had those crazy fins, but it also had the fake spare bump
right
on the trunk lid, too, on top of it.
Right. And even the 59 Continental, I mean, that was a little oddball, too, you know? So, there's interesting cars, and what's so fascinating about them, you know, you see one of those things a mile away, half mile away, you know exactly what's coming at you, as opposed to today where you can walk up to a car and you still don't even know what it is. So, yeah, gotta love 50s cars.
59 Buick, the angriest car ever built. I mean,
oh, yes.
You look at the face on that car, the way those canted headlights are there with that big toothy grill. It's just an angry-looking car. I love those cars. I had one for a while. Sold it to a friend of mine. 59 Buick, a really angry-looking car.
Well, speaking of Buick, what about the 50 Buick, right, with the big teeth?
Oh, yeah.
And then was it the 50 or 51 DeSoto that had those giant toothed grill too? I mean, you know, plating one of those grills today, I understand, is like $3,000-$4,000 alone. Those bumpers and grills, just very expensive.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. Probably, I don't know, these days probably even more than that with inflation.
Yeah.
But yeah, just great looking stuff. The 59 Lincoln, I love the 58, 59, and 60 Lincolns. So they take a particular taste in cars to really, really love those cars. But, yeah, I thought they were just so cool and so big. World's largest production car.
Yeah, it's huge.
really, 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 really good stuff.
And then, you know, you have the Chrysler letter cars, which were all fascinating, and especially the C300, the first one. That was an absolutely stunning automobile, and it has, like, you know, it's just very stout looking. It looks muscular, you know. It just has a great look to it. So, and the dashboards, of course, with the giant, you know, round gauges, and, man, I love those early, you know, letter cars. Nice stuff.
I agree.
They were doing great things in Detroit. Yep. So, anyway, we're getting close to the end, folks, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We're getting close to the end. But, you know, hey, in the meantime, remember, always, cheap cars are good. Cheap tools are bad.
All bad. No good. Stay away.
And get off the couch, get in the garage, and we'll see you guys next time.
All right. Take care, folks.
Take care. Bye, everyone.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.